Mark, and I decided to tackle the Olivet Discourse, Mark 13, that is, in terms of three installments, and this now is intended to be the final one. Our text begins in verse 28 of Mark 13. I shall wait until you have located the passage in your Bible. So, from the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But concerning that day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his servants in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to stay awake. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening or at midnight, or when the cock crows, or in the morning, lest he come suddenly and find you asleep. And what I say to you, I say to all, stay awake. A brief summary of what we have found so far in the Olivet Discourse. Verses 1 through 27, all that we have discussed so far are an answer to the initial question of the disciples, which question is located in verse 4 in this text. Tell us, when will these things be? And they have just been talking about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. When will these things be? And what will be the sign thereof, or the signs thereof? When all these things are to be accomplished. Now, in the first installment of our discussion of this text, said that verses 5 through 23 concern the events that are most closely related to the cross and 70 AD as the destruction of Jerusalem. We've also argued, and I've made this very emphatic because I think it is crucial for your understanding of this text and its language, that the cross and the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD ought to be viewed, and certainly Jesus views them this way, as forming a unity. You ought not to think of these two as separate events that have little or no relation to each other. Even from a logical vantage point, the destruction of Jerusalem is a logical outgrowth of the rejection of the Messiah, which, as we all know, culminated in his crucifixion, the cross. So these two form a unity in the economy of God and not merely in the timeline of history, where they are also fairly closely related. There's not much time between the resurrection and the cross, of course, and 70 AD. Then, the last time we met to discuss the Olivet Discourse, we tackled 24 through 27. And we did say that in this passage, a decisive shift occurs. Can anyone remember what this shift occurs? What this shift consists of? Please excuse me. What does it consist of? There is, first of all, a heightened use of cosmic language. Language that describes all of creation, even the luminaries such as the sun and the stars, which are here said to be darkened and refuse to give their light. Even the powers of the heavens, the universe, is shaken. So this is language that does set this passage somewhat apart from the rest of this Olivet discourse, where you do have global language, but not at this scale. This is different. Also, and certainly more importantly, there is a shift in terms of the personal pronoun that is used. Up until this point, Jesus addressed the disciples in the second person plural, you. In this passage, 24 through 27, there is talk of them, which suggests that while verses 1 through 23 concern events that the disciples would live through and experience, 24 through 27, not so. And finally, the language in verses 24 through 27 is clearly echoing the prophetic idiom of theophany in the Old Testament. All the language of these cosmic upheavals of the sun darkened and the moon not giving its light is found in the prophets of the Old Testament, where this language indicates the arrival of God the warrior, or the coming of God the warrior. And this is the end of the world, we concluded. Rather than to say, this is speaking of the cross, rather than to say this is limited to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, or both, this language, being set apart from the context, is speaking about the end proper. More than that, remember that since the original concern of the disciples has to do with the destruction of the temple, the cosmic imagery of the temple, namely that the temple has always been, as well as the tabernacle in Moses' day and age, that the temple has always been a picture of the entire world. And we don't have time to expound this now, but I've done this in previous occasions. The temple was a picture with all of its furnishings and with its architecture of the entire cosmos in which God dwells. And the destruction of this temple, therefore, also pointed to, or was a symbol of, or foreboded the end of the world, the destruction of the world in which we live. So, in saying what he says in verses 24 through 27, Jesus gives the disciples more than they bargained for. They only wanted to know about the destruction of Jerusalem, but Jesus pushes the envelope and he talks even about the end of the world proper. But in his inspired vision and understanding of the last things, or eschatology as the technical term is, the destruction of the temple does both relate to the death of Christ and the end of the world proper. And so he includes the discussion of the end of the world in verses 24 through 27. He answers the question of the disciples in his own way and with a level of perception that certainly eluded the disciples at that time. But there would come a time when the disciples would make more sense of his words. Well, now the Olivet Discourse concludes with two similes. The first one found in verses 28 through 31, the simile of the blossoming fig tree. And the other one in verses 32 through 37, being the master on a journey, coupled with the unknowability of the precise timing of his return. It is helpful to remind ourselves at this point that in essence, Jesus' discourse is over in verse 27. He's answered the question of the disciples. He's even offered a small window to the end of the world. And what follows in the text that we are concerned with today, he is offering an application. These verses are an application of the foregone teachings in the Olivet Discourse. Therefore, The imperative of verse 33, be on guard, keep awake, applies both to the fig tree as well as to the simile or the parable of the master on a journey. Discerning the signs of the time according to the parable of the fig tree, that's all very fine, that's good, but only if it leads us to live a watchful life. By the same token, the unknowability of the precise timing of the day of the Lord, or the day and the hour as Christ puts it in verse 32, requires an attitude of watchfulness, doesn't it? Lest one is unprepared for the coming of the kingdom. So the imperative be on guard applies to both of these pericopes, the fig tree and the master on a journey. Now, I have two preliminary observations in regards of these verses that we need to take account before we talk about this language in detail. First, and I've already implied as much, when viewed from a distance, the two similes, the two parables, if you will, create a certain tension, don't they? Whereas the first one, the fig tree, speaks of knowability. To read the signs of the times implies that you need to be able to know. The second one seems to deconstruct this anticipation and says, but you cannot know. You cannot know the day or the hour. And that needs to be properly taken account of, because that tension is there for a good, good reason. The other noteworthy feature of the language of our text tonight is quite obvious. It lies in its return to the direct address that has been suspended in verses 24 through 27, where the personal pronoun is third person plural, they. Now we are back to you, my disciples, you. That is surely significant and needs to be taken into account too. In fact, what Jesus is saying by the resumption of the use of the second person plural is that you, my disciples, will experience the times that I describe. You will experience them. Now let's begin with the lesson of the fig tree. What's the gist of it? What's the gist of this parable of the fig tree? Nah, come on, you know this. Huh? Huh? Pay attention to signs. In other words, appealing to nature, Jesus says that just as you know that plant growth is the harbinger of summer, it announces the coming of summer, so also certain events announce or are the harbinger of the fulfillment of all these things. He says in verse 29, these signs, if properly interpreted, will inform the disciples that he or it is near at the very gates. Now, what does all these things refer to? It certainly refers to a reference or things that Jesus has talked about previously. That's logical, isn't it? When he says, when you see all these things, know that he is near, he must be talking about something that he just talked about in his speech to the disciples on the Mount of Olives. That's logical. That makes perfect sense. I want to ask you the question, though, where have you heard this phrase before, all these things, in the discourse of Mark 13? Where? Absolutely. Once again, I say, you must keep in mind as you read and try to understand this passage, the original question of the disciples. And all these things is a very significant phrase within this discourse. Yes, it is first mentioned in the question of the disciples when they say, tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things are about to be accomplished? Also remember that there's a third time that this phrase occurs. It occurs in verse 23b, when Jesus, after finishing the first section that dealt with the cross in 70 AD, says, be on guard. I have foretold you all these things. Now, when in the parable of the fig tree this phrase occurs one more time, you are to make this connection to the question of the disciples in verse 4 and also the repetition of this in verse 23, which also gives you the referent. When all these things are being talked about, Jesus speaks of the cross in 70 AD. The disciples, remember, second person plural, you, the disciples will see certain signs that Jesus has talked about. And what are these signs? These signs are 13 verse 10, the preaching of the gospel to all nations. And Jesus says to his disciples, the 12 apostles, when you see this taking place, know that it is very near. Do you remember how we dealt with this seeming problem? Because you are inclined to think that the preaching of the gospel to all nations did not happen in the first century AD, that is, in the lifetime of the disciples. But actually, we learned, and I think that we were on very safe ground, that the gospel had already reached the ends of the earth before 70 AD, that is, within the lifetime of the apostles. How do we know this, Mr. Hogan? And most significantly, the Acts of the Apostles that was written before 70 AD, and a book that argues, the whole point of the book is to argue that the gospel goes from Jerusalem to the ends of the earth, even within the lifetime of the Apostle Paul. Acts 1:8, if you don't believe it, read up on it. There is an inner biblical witness that teaches us that in some sense, maybe not in the ultimate sense, but in a true and biblical sense, the gospel had reached the nations before 70 AD. And therefore, this is a perfectly legitimate way of talking about the signs of the coming destruction of Jerusalem. Jesus says to his disciples, and you got to remember, from their vantage point, sitting on that Mount of Olives, vis-a-vis the temple in Jerusalem, they're still on the Old Testament side of things. For them to see the gospel preached to the nation is unheard of. This is this is a scandalous concept. And Jesus says, nevertheless, when you see it happening, know that the end of Jerusalem or the temple is very near. Okay? Now the other sign that he was talking about is found in verses 11 following. He speaks there of persecution. The disciples can expect persecution. He says, when they bring you to trial and deliver you over, do not be anxious beforehand what you are to say, but say whatever is given you in that hour, for it is not you who speak, but the Holy Spirit. That too was fulfilled within the lifetime of the apostles and is another conclusive sign that the end would be near. Another sign, and we dealt with this in the first installment of our studies, is found in verses 6 following, the sign of deception. That is, prophetic or messianic lunatics. or pretenders. Jesus, lists this as the first of the signs that will tell the disciples that the end must be just around the corner. Remember what we learned from Josephus? A couple of weeks ago, we read Josephus, and Josephus noted that there was remarkable clustering of messianic and prophetic figures that claimed to have something to say in the first century, beginning with 4 BC all the way to 70 AD, and particularly in the years of the Jewish War, 66 leading up to 70. So apparently, these things really did shake out the way that Jesus predicted. There were many who claimed to be prophets in those great upheavals of the times that led to the destruction of Jerusalem, and there were many who pretended to be the king or a messianic leader of some kind. All of them perished. And then, of course, there is another sign. Actually, two, but they're one and the same. The sign of unprecedented tribulation, talked about in verses 14 following, and the abomination of desolation. How did we interpret this language, and what does it refer to? In this context, it does refer to the cross of Christ. The greatest sacrilege that has been committed was not the desecration of the temple in Jerusalem, but the temple of Christ's body, the real temple. And at the same time, the Romans did do what Antiochus Epiphanes did in 167 BC in desecrating the temple too. They did it as well. So there is that level of fulfillment too, but this unprecedented tribulation that has not been since the beginning of the world can refer to the siege of Jerusalem and the fall of Jerusalem in which women even ate their own babies. However, I believe that Christ also has an eye on the cross. There is no greater tribulation than the time when the light of the world was eclipsed by the judgment of the Almighty. That's the unprecedented tribulation, and it is the abomination of desolation. In our previous studies, then, we related all these elements to the cross and 70 AD, and we noted, and we say it again, the two form a unity. They belong together. That's one idea, one complex of idea. So I say it now, and I know that some of you will be surprised. The fig tree symbolism does not likely extend to verses 24 through 27. Remember what we said about the shift in personal pronoun. 24 through 27 does not address the disciples directly. The fig tree does, suggesting that they will live through this period. They will see it happening. Also, and this is a logical consideration, the signs of theophany, darkening of the sun, falling of the stars, powers of the heavens being shaken, the whole world being in convulsion and shivering and tottering at the presence of the Almighty, the signs of theophany are typically consequences of the arrival. That is to say, the signs of the coming of the warrior of God, of Christ, they are so completely one with the event or with his arrival that they cannot be viewed as premonitory signs, because when you see them happening, it's too late. He's already there. He's not even near, he's already there. So when you consider the language of verses 24 through 27, the signs of theophany, they are not merely heralds of his coming, they are his coming. And there's no time left when these things happen. That's the end of the world proper. When therefore Jesus speaks of these things in the lesson of the fig tree, he would have expected his disciples to recognize the phrase as referring to true forerunners of the event and not the event itself. Do you understand me? Do you follow me? It doesn't make sense to speak of signs, if rightly interpreted, leading you to conclude that the end is near when the signs are already the end and there is no time left to repent or to turn or to be ready. There's no logic in this. As an aside, and I do concede that this is somewhat speculative on my part, but I too at times take the liberty of uttering my own opinion. I do not believe that Jesus believed the end would come within the lifetime of his apostles. I do not believe that he was that limited in his view of the end of time proper. And I have reasons for this too. I will not expound them now. But this brings us to the crucial phrase, this generation, that he uses in the fig tree parable. Before we get to this, let me say that the majority of the exegetes throughout the centuries to the present day have viewed Mark 13:20, where it says, excuse me, 13:30, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. The majority of exegetes to the present day have taken verse 30 as relating to the events leading up to and including the parousia of Christ. That, again, is the end of the world proper. Calvin's great influence led to the revival of an ancient interpretation, but forgotten interpretation until Calvin revived it, so to speak. An interpretation of this passage that goes all the way back to the early church fathers, according to which the saying of the fig tree aims not at the end of the world proper, but to something that the disciples themselves would experience, and that something is the fall of Jerusalem. In other words, what Jesus then is saying with the parable of the fig tree is, in summary, keep in mind what I said to you about the events leading up to the fall of the temple or the fall of Jerusalem. When you see the multitude of signs coming true or being in evidence, know that it is very near. And the things that I talked about, all these things, these signs, they will allow you to come to that conclusion. Remember, I told you on our last meeting and study in the Olivet Discourse that the disciples apparently took Jesus' warning very seriously, and they were able to properly interpret their meaning, because by the time that 70 AD rolled around and the city fell to the Romans, who then established the Roman standard, the eagle in the temple at Jerusalem before they raised it, there were no Christians found in the city anymore. They had gotten out. And they must have known something. They had understood the sign of the fig tree. Now this, I believe, remains the best rendering of Christ's words. And in support of this interpretation, let me say that the strongest argument lies in the phrase, this generation. It used to be common to say that this generation refers to humankind as a whole, or the generation of the wicked from the time that Jesus spoke these words to the end of time, or to the generation of the believers from the time that Jesus spoke these words to the end of time. which was a convenient interpretative move because it allowed the interpreter to settle the event anywhere on the timeline between the cross and the end of time. Very flexible. But this is interpretative nonsense. It is surprising, isn't it, that we had to wait until the 19th century and the scholar Reimarus, who is otherwise known for the infamous Wolfenbüttel fragments, which many consider to be the pushing open of the gate to critical biblical studies, it is surprising that we had to wait until the 19th century and the remarks of Reimarus, who did away with this misunderstanding, because he argued, and he rightly argued, that there is a sheer grammatical illegitimacy to reading this generation in such broad terms. Today, we know from both the Bible or the New Testament, and in particular the Gospels, because that's the only place where this generation occurs, and also extra-biblical literature from the time, that this generation is another way of speaking of the present generation, not any old generation or generation in an ideal sense, as in all believers at all times. This generation was Jesus' way of speaking of what I used to call contemporaries. That's what that means. And I will give you a few examples. We limit ourselves to the Gospel of Mark. Please turn with me to Mark chapter 8, verse 12. Again, I say, only Jesus uses the term or phrase this generation, but whenever he does use it, it will always refer to his contemporaries. 8:12. He sighed deeply in his spirit and said, why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. And he left them, being the referent of this generation, and so forth. Then we have another reference in the same chapter in verse 38, thank you. Whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. In these words, Jesus said, whoever of you who rejects me will also be rejected when I come in power. Another reference is found in 9:19. Here, Jesus speaks of a faithless generation. How long am I to be with you? Referring to contemporaries. And you can look into the other Gospels, the parallel passages of Matthew and Luke, and the same truth is to be ascertained. This generation refers to contemporaries. Okay? That being the case, if the teaching concerning the fig tree really is about the end of time proper, it would mean that Jesus himself set the end of time within the bounds of the first generation. Church. That is his own disciples. It means that Jesus believed the end of time proper was to occur within the lifetime of his own disciples. I don't believe it. And I'm fairly certain it's not true. But if these sayings that we've looked at, these examples of the use of the phrase this generation, are only allowed to have a voice to speak for themselves, then we should come to the conclusion that the word generation denotes Jesus' contemporaries. So, the fig tree refers to something that happens within the lifetime of the disciples. Corroborating evidence, again, is the use of the second person plural. The disciples experienced this They were to see and interpret the signs, not you or I, the disciples. And this then brings us to 13:32 through 37. And I wonder whether we shouldn't stop here, because some of you already seem to be reeling, and I don't wish to do too much in this gathering. We still have next week, the Lord willing. Let me simply stop here and ask you, do you have any questions or comments? Gary.
Yeah,